You're listening to This Week in Fantasy Baseball. Hello, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Fantasy Baseball. I'm John Kuh, joined by my co-host Patrick Fitzgerald, and our guest for this week, Pitcherless writer Jack Mueller. In this episode, we're going to go over Jack's article, which previewed the 2025 international free agent class. We'll then wrap it up, kind of recapping some of the moves that have happened so far this offseason. But before we get into it, just a reminder, you can follow our podcast on Twitter at ThisWeekPL. Send us your fantasy baseball questions to our email at ThisWeekPLpod@gmail.com. Lastly, make sure you subscribe to or follow the podcast on whatever streaming platform you listen to. We're on all of them, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube. Wherever you listen, make sure you follow us and leave a five-star review if you enjoy the show. As I mentioned at the top, we're joined today by Pitcherless writer Jack Mueller. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you guys for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
Yeah, I believe, how long have you been writing for Pitcherless?
Just came up on my two-year anniversary. I started in November of 2023, so just nice. Past that mark.
Nice. And then you've been writing primarily for the Dynasty team?
Yes, pretty much only exclusively with the Dynasty team, doing okay. Prospects and organizational rankings.
Cool. How long have you been kind of just interested in Dynasty baseball? And you know, was that kind of a pretty easy thing for you to start writing about?
Yeah, I think in comparison to a lot of people in the industry, I'm pretty new to the whole Dynasty baseball thing. I can't say I was a big fantasy player growing up, but prospects and the farm system and minor league baseball has always been a part of what I watch. It's been an interest of mine since I was 10, 11 years old. So being a part of it now and being part of a larger community has been really, really cool. But I think I'm more of a novice to the Dynasty industry compared to a lot of my coworkers here at Pitcherlist.
Well, I'll say, having read some of your articles, you do a pretty good job with the analysis. So definitely appreciate your mind. Real baseball-wise, any teams that you particularly root for?
I wasn't given a choice when I was a kid. I was born and raised on the north side of Chicago, so there was only one team for me. I'm a third-generation Cubs fan. I try to go to as many games as I can. I think I passed the 40-game mark this year, so
Oh, wow.
I was pretty proud of myself. But, yeah, so born and raised diehard Chicago Cubs fan.
Oh, that's fun. We'll see if that's a good offseason for you guys. It's been some interesting moves so far.
to say I'm cautiously optimistic, but I've seen this movie before. So I'm expecting a little bit more to happen so far mm-hmm. than what's happened so far, but at the same time, I think we're in a good spot. I think we've done a good job building up the farm and putting ourselves in a position to at least compete, even if nothing else happens for mm-hmm. the rest of the way.
Yeah. So I guess fun question for you. Do you want Kyle Tucker to come back?
It's such a double-edged sword because yes, I do, because his bat unlocked so much other production in our lineup. Like, I don't think Ian Happ would have the season he did without Kyle Tucker in the lineup. I don't think Michael Bush has the season he has without Kyle Tucker in the lineup. I don't think PCA has the season anywhere close to the season he has without the protection of Kyle Tucker, but he also brings just such an element of like the added speculation, the added star power that comes with being Kyle Tucker that I don't think played into our favor this season. So it also depends on what that contract ends up being. I know the Ricketts don't have the history of spending big. So if it goes over the, you know, the 10-year, 11-year mark, I think they're going to balk and let him walk somewhere else.
Yeah. It's going to be one of those really interesting questions. That, you know, they basically didn't do any negotiations, I think, throughout the year. And then the qualifying offer just kind of felt like, I mean, obviously you have to offer it. But right. Also, it's like, you know, it'd be nice to maybe get a little bit more substance behind the talks rather than just like, we're going to give you the qualifying offer and then just see what happens and see if you have a market. And if you don't, then, you know, we'll see if we can sign you for a little cheaper than maybe what you were expecting. So we'll see how that all shakes out. But it would be nice to kind of get back to, you know, maybe the mid 2010s Cubs, because it feels like it's been a little rough ever since that point.
Yeah, you're telling me. I missed those days. That was like right when I really started getting into baseball for real. So I felt like I was a little spoiled. And then obviously the 2021 trade deadline really brought me back down to earth and what it's really, what it's really like to be a Cubs fan. I mean, watching
exactly.
Frank Schwindel be my star player in 2022 was really something. So. But no, I feel like I have the Cubs fan experience now. I've seen it to be on the losing end a little bit. So now I want to get back to the mid-2010s, the winning.
Yeah, well, I'm a Twins fan. Patrick's an Orioles fan. So at least you've got the World Series to witness. We don't That's have true. That right now. So
absolutely.
Nice. Well, yeah, we're going to dive into your article. Basically, you just kind of covered most, if not all, I think most of the 2025 international free agent class. Obviously, there's a ton of players that could be considered international free agents. But you focused on 10 of them. We're going to really look at maybe the top three that you listed in the article, and then a couple of the other guys that, you know, might have an impact in fantasy. But, you know, the three main guys, I think everyone who's following baseball closely would probably know, Munetaka Murakami, Tatsuya Imai, and Kazuma Okamoto. And all those guys are coming over from Japan. None of them maybe have like the cachet that like, you know, Sasaki or Yamamoto had the past couple seasons, or even, you know, obviously Shohei Ohtani, but all of them could be certainly contributors to a baseball team this year. And so it's kind of important to know, you know, hey, what is it look, what are the outlook for these guys looks like in 2026 and beyond? Because obviously you kind of wrote this from a little bit of a dynasty perspective. We're going to start with Murakami. And I think the criticism I've seen across the board on him, yes, the power is incredible, but the dude just swings and misses like none other. And it's not something that he's been able to really fix in Japan, it looks like. He's been, I believe, in their kind of top league for, I think you mentioned, the last 8 years or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, I guess the hope for fans is, hey, he comes over here to a major league squad. He gets major league coaching in the United States. Maybe that helps with that swing and miss. Do you think that's possible? Do you think that's like a potential actual solution for Murakami and, you know, what's kind of going on with his approach at the plate?
Yeah, it's certainly the hope. That said, trying to change the swing decisions, trying to change the swing trajectory of an 8-year pro, especially one who's played in such an elite league like the NPB, is really, really hard. I mean, 17, like almost over 17% swinging strike rate would be the worst in Major League Baseball this year by a couple percentage points. That's a pretty bad starting point, especially when you consider the regression that takes place when a player comes from Japan, comes into Major League Baseball. There's not much room for error in terms of that getting any worse without really sacrificing a lot of production. That said, it's not impossible to be a bad strike hitter and still have power potential. I mean, the top three in swinging strike rate this year were Brandon Lau, Hunter Goodman, and P. Crow Armstrong. All three of those guys all hit 30 home runs. So it's certainly possible to counteract the swing and miss rate with elite power, and there's no question that Murakami has that elite power. If he makes enough contact, this is a 35 home run hitter, no doubt in my mind. But I think the biggest fear is the regression that is going to occur with him coming over, because that 17% is already at the top of the worst of the worst. And if it gets any lower, you're looking at a player that you can't put in the lineup. So I think it's certainly possible for Major League coaching to make a dent in it, but I don't think it's possible for him to, you know, jump into like the 12 to 15% swinging strike rate. It's still going to be in the 17 to 20%. And the question will be, how do you maximize the contact he does make to offset that swinging strike, the swing and miss issues with elite production with his power?
And I mean, I think one of the challenges too is that, you know, you mentioned, you know, you can swing and miss a lot. You just have to make contact, but he doesn't have great contact rates either, right? And so that's also part of the issue, is that he's whiffing a lot, but he's also not making as much contact as, you know, maybe his peers would be in the majors.
Yeah, I mean, his contact rate is among the lowest I've seen on any of the players I've looked at. I think it was about 63% in the NPB. Again, if you account for the regression that you're going to have when you come to Major League Baseball with that learning curve of elite pitching, and not even to mention the added velocity, which has been a subject of discussion around the Twitter sphere that I've seen in the last couple of weeks, that could get even lower. If that drops into the 50%, into 55%, 58%, that's borderline unplayable. And that's really hard. And you can't, as I said before, it's really hard to change the swing decisions and the swing attack plan for an 8-year pro who's already spent significant time being a star in his league. Not only is it just a mechanical thing, and not only is it just an approach thing, but it's just an ego thing where he's spent so long as this elite power hitter because of his approach, because of his swing decisions. And now you're telling him after 200 plus home runs in the NPB to change all of that. I'm not sure it's going to have as much of a positive effect as it would in theory, as it would in practice.
And one thing, you know, you talk about all of these clear warts in the profile of Murakami, right, which they do seem, you know, plain as day. But at the same time, like you said in the article, he should be the clear number one pick in FYPDs, right? We all know, or at least expect him to get a nine-figure contract, right? So he has the pop to hopefully make up for the contact. And I'm curious with the FYPD thing, do you feel like he'd be the number one pick like almost any year? Is it just because it's a little bit of a weaker class this year? Like, I'm thinking back to last year, like, 2024, like Travis Bezanna, Chase Burns, like that class. Do you think that he would go ahead of those guys, or is it just more a statement of the top of the class this year?
I still think he goes ahead of like the Bezanna tier. I think if it was like a Paul Skeens draft, I think that's a much more strong conversation because of the super prospect that Skeens was. But I think when you're taking a prospect like Murakami, you're betting on the player he is 2 years from now or a year from now when he has a full season of MLB experience under his belt. He's seen pitching. He's adjusted to the velocity. He's adjusted to the major league lifestyle. Because, I mean, that's travel. As competitive as the NPB is, the travel in the United States, it's just a much larger span. It's a lot more eyes on this league. So that transition cannot be understated. So I think having a year of experience under his belt will definitely assist in his production. Will it turn into a drop in strikeout rate, turn into making more contact? My gut feeling says no, but I think maybe some of the swings that would have resulted in pop-ups or ground balls in the first season may turn into line drives and homers in the second season. So I think you can swallow a year of adjustment with Murakami because of the elite power upside he brings. He's going to strike out a ton, but if he makes enough contact to hit 40 home runs, you can make up that swing and miss in other areas of your lineup.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I guess I'm curious, you know, you kind of talked about maybe some warts in the first year. You know, what do you see as like a realistic projection? You know, not necessarily like a ceiling or a floor, but just like, hey, like this would be nice to have for Murakami. You could see it happening.
Yeah, I tried so hard to not include this name in the article because it just felt like such a lazy comparison. But I did write down in my notes that 2017 Joey Gallo is just the easy comparison where he's going to hit a ton of home runs. Joey Gallo hit 41 that year and strike out a ton. Gallo struck out 30% of the time with a 20% swing strike rate. But still, when he made contact, he hit the ball really hard. Gallo's hard hit rate was approaching 50%. If Murakami gets anywhere close to that, that's a good season in my mind, especially for a guy in his first season of the major leagues. Steamer, I thought, was pretty harsh on him in terms of like Fangraphs' posted projections. They said he was going to hit 223 with a 115 WRC plus with 22 home runs. I definitely think he gets a few more than that. I could see him getting at least into like close to 30, flirting with 30. I'd say 27 would be my floor for him. I think my like most realistic but somewhat optimistic projection, I had him down as like a 240 hitter with a 120 WRC plus. 2 to 2.5 WAR, 30 home runs, 35% strikeout rate. I think with the contract he's expected to get, especially with the upside he has, especially a couple of years with MLB experience down the line, I think it's pretty darn good production for a guy getting into the major leagues for his first year, especially with the profile that he has.
Yeah, and I think with Murakami, I don't know, there's just something there that's like, if he's on the right team, he could get a bunch of RBIs. You know, baseball is kind of going away from like the three true outcomes just a little bit. I mean, I would say it's not like a wholesale thing, but you see a lot of teams that are like trying to have more of a contact focused approach, right? And Murakami is a little bit different than that. But yeah, I think that profile still probably plays a little bit in today's league and still could generate, you know, a decent number of RBI and probably not as many runs, but you know, it could generate you know, a decent amount of offense for sure.
Yeah, I could 100% see him fitting in like a 4 or 5 hole with a competitive team and be a troop. I mean, like I said with Tucker, like he just unlocks so many other things in your lineup because you have to pitch to him so carefully. And he's just another player to worry about in the middle of that lineup. Even if you can get away with some of the pitches, you can't get away with sluggers who have been in the big leagues for a little bit longer. You can get away with some in zone misses because of his swinging strike rate. You still have to pitch to him carefully because if you miss your spot, that ball's not coming back. And he is capable of hitting the baseball a million feet. Like he's that talented. He's got that much power that it should still make teams worry about him in a way that maybe some players with the same swing strike rate and the swing and miss issues with less power maybe don't have the same kind of threat. But he should still get a significant contract and still be a middle of the order hitter for most big league teams this year.
So jumping from the guy who's expected to be the best hitter in the class to the best pitcher, Tatsuya Imai, also coming over from NPB. He is a little bit older than some of the pitchers we've seen come over recently, specifically Yamamoto and Sasaki. Do you think that experience, you know, having just a little bit more professional time under his belt, you think it'll help him have a more seamless transition to MLB, or do you think that there might be a little bit of an adjustment period like we saw, especially for Roki Sasaki this past year?
I think it'll definitely help with like the intangibles of just being a pro and be dealing with the pressures of being a major league player. Obviously, depending on the market in which he signs with, and we're kind of expecting it to be a big market, that comes with the added media pressure, that comes with the added, you know, outside factors. I think the added years of experience will help with that. I'm not sure it'll help with the actual tangible on the field performance per se. That said, I do think that he has the talent to step in day one and be a solid SP two or three on most teams in the league. Obviously there's some teams that have just super rotations and he'd, you know, be four on, but this is a guy that's going to start 25 to 30 games in the big leagues next year and give you, if not above average, really, really good production. I'm not going to go like elite yet, because obviously the transition from overseas leagues to the big leagues has been proven to be pretty tough, but this is a guy I'm expecting to, you know, be a legitimate starter for a playoff team next year. Obviously that also depends on which team he decides to sign with, but I think that, yeah, well, to your point, to your question, I think that it'll help with his professionalism, but I am expecting him to handle the transition better than Sasaki did for sure.
Right. And he does seem to have like the mentality in terms of, you know, talking about wanting the spotlight, wanting to take on other Japanese players and the Dodgers specifically. It seems like he, you know, it might be built for that pressure. So that's cool to see. I think the fastball, it sounds like, is going to be really his carrying pitch. You know, it has really nice shape, not crazy break numbers, but the low release helps it play up. So I've heard a lot of Joe Ryan comparisons, which is definitely exciting. But at the same time, Joe Ryan is as good as he is because of his command as well as his shape. And I think that the command might not quite be there as much with Imai, at least not for a longer track record, right? Yeah, he's kind of been cutting his walk rate, but I don't know. What do you think is kind of his carrying tool? Do you think it's the raw stuff, or do you think he's just a really well-rounded arm?
I think it'll be two things. One, you hit the nail on the head. I think the command's going to be the big question mark. If he's able to keep runners off the base paths via the walk, he's going to be in good shape. In this pitch data NPB Streamlit app I found, this loves the slider in terms of the metric called XPV. As I was saying a little bit pre-show, I can't speak to how it measures it or what kind of metrics it puts into the model, but it thinks it's one of the best pitches in the NPB. And I think it has the shape and the stuff to play in the big leagues too. It's a really, really aesthetically pleasing pitch that really sets up the rest of his arsenal well. Because as you said, the fastball's really darn good, sitting mid-90s with a ton of arm side run. He sets that up well with two off-speed pitches, one being a splitter that looks just insane when you watch it on film. It's got a ton of horizontal dive. And then the changeup I haven't seen a ton of, but the same model loves it, giving it like a 3.6 on the XPV scale. So I think the stuff's going to be the carrying factor, but I think the fastball and slider are going to be 100% the two pitches that are going to be his bread and butter. I expect that to be 60 to 70% of his usage next year. But yeah, like you said, I think the command's going to be the big question mark. If he can keep that walks per nine under 3.2, 3.5, I think he's in good shape. Obviously you cut it by a ton down to 2.5 last year, but obviously with the regression we're expecting coming to the major leagues, I'm expecting that to jump back up to like the mid threes. Anything higher than that, and he's in the danger zone. But if he keeps it in that range, I think he's going to set himself up for success.
Yeah, I think that's what made this past year so interesting for him. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned he get a 0.89 whip, but it was compared to the previous season, 1.165. So he saw a dramatic improvement both in reducing hits and reducing walks. So it's kind of just hoping like, hey, like even if he could be in that 2024 form, with walks per nine was 3.6, so kind of, you know, hovering around that number you mentioned. The improvement we saw this year from him was pretty drastic, which I don't know if that's going to be something that's going to hold in 2026 or if he's going to kind of get back to, you know, maybe the player he was in 2023 and 2024.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is going to, that 2025 season is going to help him in contract negotiations. I think it remains to be seen how much it helps him on the field. Even if he regresses to the mean back to that 3.6 number, as long as he doesn't dive back up to those 2023, 2022 numbers where it's, you know, fives and fours. And even in those years, he was still, you know, getting 2.5s, 2.4s in ERA. But I think as long as he stays below that four range, even a little higher, I think he can get away with it just because of the stuff he has. And just because, as Patrick said, the unique arm slot that he brings, I think he can get away with a little bit less control. Obviously, teams will want him to continue to work on that, especially as he sees teams more than once. But I think he, right now he's got a good base to stand on. He's got a good, you know, launching off point to start his career. I think he's definitely the safest bet in terms of overseas pitching coming over. And that's why he's going to get the contract he's going to get, because he's not only safe in terms of his floor, but his ceiling could be ace level. I know we've said that before about pitchers coming over. I know that's, you know, kind of that term's thrown around loosely sometimes, but truly with Amai, it seems like he has the upside to be a top of the rotation kind of guy.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, moving on to Kazuma Okamoto. So I think he's definitely been overshadowed by the fact that Murakami is also coming over, right? He's also a first baseman, or at least, you know, a corner infielder. A little bit older as well, 29 years old. But you look at his numbers, and I'm literally just kind of reading the stuff that you wrote on the article, and you're like, this is really solid dude, right? Walks as much as he strikes out. He's got a contact rate of 80%, right? Compare that to Murakami, who had some really awful contact rates at 64%, and that's like, oh, that's really good. So yeah, obviously getting a little overshadowed, just being a little bit older, not having maybe the flash, the power that Murakami has. What do you just like about Okamoto's game? You know, what about his game really think makes you think he'll be able to fit into a major league offense in 2026?
Yeah, he just strikes me as the kind of guy that does everything well and maybe doesn't have like an elite tool the way that Murakami's power truly stands out. Okamoto's a true all-around kind of offensive player. Doesn't hit for like elite power, but can still give you 20 to 25 home runs over the course of a year. Good bat to ball, as I mentioned in the article, the 80% contact rate. Obviously older, so more years under his belt than some of his competitors in the market. But yeah, you look through his track record, walk rates above 10, strikeout rates below 20% for the last 3 years, all of that with WRC pluses and the NPB above 160, just does everything well. Obviously doesn't stand out a ton, and obviously some of those tools could be diminished coming to the United States, but he stood out to me just as a guy who you can rely on at a price point that's a little bit safer than some of the other first basemen on the market, and especially at with the price point that Murakami's at. ESPN had him at $12 million a year last I looked. That puts you in Jake Cronenworth, Yandy Diaz range, which obviously I'm not sure Okamoto gets there immediately, but I think he certainly has the skill set to get to that 2.5 to 3 war range that both of those guys sat in last year. The Fangraphs depth charts projections don't like him at all. They have him as a 75 WRC plus hitter. I think that's incredibly harsh. I would be shocked if he's anywhere below the 100 mark next year. But yeah, I think that Okamoto is just kind of the safe play, and he's just indicative of everything you look for when you're looking for a kind of modern big league hitter. He hits the ball hard, can give you decent power, gets on base enough. And I don't think the glove's going to win any gold gloves, but I think it's good enough to stick at first base. So you don't have to worry about him switching over to the DH spot as maybe you would with Murakami.
And I'm kind of just curious, because I know, like, with Amai, you mentioned, right, like, there's some advanced stats with him. With Okamoto, and I guess with Murakami as well, you know, how do their – do we have any data on, like, hard hit rates or, you know, kind of their exit velocities at all? I'm just curious.
There's been some posted around. There's no site that carries them all in one place, so it's just kind of scattered around the internet, depending on how deep you want to look. I know Murakami's hard hit or exit velocities – are elite in comparison to some of the other players in that league. I didn't see anything on Okamoto as far as I could go back, or at least none that stick out in my memory. But I mean, I can't imagine given these numbers, he'd be anywhere from like the lower than like 37% hard hit rate. Mm-hmm. He should be easily in the 40s. He may not be in the, you know, 48 to 50% that Murakami is likely in, but he's definitely, he hits the ball hard enough to do decent damage, and he's done that for the last 3 years at least, and even going back even further. I mean, his lowest WRC plus is in 2019 with a 121. So, and obviously, even with the regression that you expect with coming to Major League Baseball, that should still sit comfortably in the low end of the floor being like 90 and the ceiling being like the 120s range.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the 15 homers in 69 games is the thing that kind of speaks to me, because you just look at it and you're like, 15, that's kind of low, but he did it in essentially, you know, half a MLB baseball season. So, mm-hmm. you know, being able to get to 20, 25 seems realistic for this guy. And then just the fact that the ratios just look that much better than Murakami, it is. Not saying he's going to end up with, you know, better fantasy numbers, but it's not, a bad thing if you end up with him on your fantasy team for sure.
No, he's definitely a tier below Murakami in terms of upside. Obviously, having 4 years or 2 years, I believe 3 years maybe, an age obviously lowers his value a little bit. But I wrote down 20 home runs, 250 average with an 800-ish OPS doesn't seem out of the question for this profile. Obviously, that could be a little aggressive on my part given how harsh Fangraphs is on him. But I mean, even with if you're regressing both the walk rate and the strikeout rate, if you're regressing the bat to ball contact, if you're regressing the power, he still puts up really, really good numbers and should squarely find himself in the top, if not top 15, top 20 first baseman conversation. Obviously, it's a pretty loaded position, so it's you can get away with not having him on your team if there's other options out there. But if you need help at first base and Okamoto's there in your first year player draft, this feels like a slam dunk as a guy who can give you production from day one.
Yeah, and before we transition to the next tier of guys in your piece, I just wanted to ask real quick. Obviously, we don't care a lot about defense in fantasy, but we do in terms of positional eligibility. And obviously, third base is in a lot worse shape than first. Do you feel like either one of these guys, Okamoto or Murakami, has any chance to maintain that eligibility, or do you think they're mostly just going to be first base only?
I would be shocked if either one is given the chance to. For everything I've read and everything I've seen so far has both squarely set at first base. Out of the two, I could see them maybe giving Okamoto a shot, given he had, if I remember correctly, more time there in 2025. Murakami seems just a profile that fits better as a first baseman or a DH. Okamoto could get a run, but I don't see it sticking as opposed to some of the other defensive options that are out there. Obviously, defense doesn't matter as much in fantasy, but it matters for teams trying to win ball games on the field. Neither of these guys seem like good enough gloves to warrant sticking at third for 2025, at least. I could be wrong. I don't know what teams are thinking. I can't say I watch these guys play the field a ton, but from everything I've seen, it seems like both of these guys are squarely projected to be first baseman next year.
Yeah, maybe we can hold out hope in our Yahoo, you know, five-game eligibility.
Hey, you never know. Anything's possible.
I mean, the year that Vlad got third base eligibility last year was one of the best years of life.
So transitioning now, all right, we've covered the top three, and then the next category in your article is MLB contributors, right? So guys who aren't as high profile but could play useful roles. So we have two NPB guys and two KBO guys, Anthony Kay, who just signed with the Cubs, I believe, Foster Griffin, Cody Ponce, who just signed with the Blue Jays, and Song Moon Song from the KBO. So two of those guys still unsigned, two of them are signed. Is there any one of them that kind of sticks out to you, at least for fantasy purposes at this point?
Yeah, you know, Anthony Kay really made this easier for me because he was going to be the guy I picked. And then about an hour after I started doing my research, he got signed. So, yeah, I think the White Sox had a really good one. He's a tall lefty, has MLB experience, doesn't have the upside that Ponce does. And I'll get to that in a second. But Anthony Kay strikes me as a guy that's going to be in the rotation for the entire year. The White Sox simply just need arms. They're in another rebuild year. They need to eat innings through somebody, and Anthony Kay seems like a prime candidate to do so. They're also a team that's frankly not going to be competitive, and if Anthony Kay puts together a solid year where he's around the 3-4 ERA range, that's a great trade deadline target for a competing team in need of another lefty to throw 30 to 40 innings down the stretch. He came, if I remember correctly, when he was in the majors before the NPB, he was like a two pitch guy. I believe I looked at his fastball slider. His arsenal is up to five pitches now. And he in an article that I read when I was researching for the article, he said he added a two seam, which totally unlocked his game. And going back to that NPB pitch data site I alluded to earlier and is linked in the article, that pitch is by far his best pitch in his repertoire. So I think that brings a whole nother level to his game if he's able to hone in on that more well-rounded arsenal that he had than his first time in the big leagues. And I think he'll get a lot of run to do so with the White Sox that simply just need people to throw innings. So if you're looking for a safe option in the back end of your starting rotation or to throw in on your bench on a flyer, Anthony Kay's your guy. Colin Ponce, I believe, or Cody Ponce, excuse me. I can't believe I got that wrong twice. Cody Ponce is the upside play out of the two. He fits the bill that you look for on a big league starter. I mean, he's 6'6", 250 with an upper 90s fastball, low 90s slider. I mean, the strikeout numbers speak for themselves. 250 strikeouts in 170 innings in the KBO is just outrageous. He scares me a little bit more just because of how crowded that bull, that Blue Jays rotation is now. Obviously, now Jose Berríos on the outside looking in, if Fangraphs's depth charts are correct. I think his leash is going to be a lot shorter than Kay's is, which worries me a little bit. If Ponce comes over, struggles to get outs in his first two or three starts, he could be resigned to a bullpen role by May, as opposed to Kay could probably get into, if all else fails, he'll probably still be starting games in the summer. Whereas if Ponce struggles, that team's competing to go back to the World Series. His runway is going to be a lot shorter, and they have guys who can step up and fill those innings. So obviously, out of the two, Ponce is the upside play. He could be a solid SP3 on a lot of teams if it clicks. I'm just concerned that it won't click, and he'll end up being a bullpen guy, which he also, again, has the frame and the fastball velocity to be. There's a solid chance with the question marks in the Blue Jays bullpen that we saw during the postseason that he becomes a high leverage guy for them. Not necessarily a bad thing in real life, but in fantasy baseball, that makes him a whole lot less valuable than a guy who can get you, you know, six innings of five strikeout ball on a weekly basis. So out of the two, I lean K, but Ponce is not exactly a bad option if you're chasing upside.
Right. And I think it's important to note that, you know, you can't compare the overseas numbers apples to apples, right? KBO is a pretty offensively friendly league, and MPB is kind of just in like a dead ball period. I think the league average ERA is like a 3. So, you know, it's really important to be looking at league adjusted numbers for these guys, like, you know, WRC plus and those other types of numbers that you reference in the piece.
Yeah. And even if you adjust for that, I think K's just got more experience at the big league level, if I remember correctly. Like, he just seemed, it's more of a feel thing at this point. Like, I can't say I have a ton of data to back this up, but for me, just on a feel basis, I think K is just the safe play. But if you're chasing a guy that can go and get you elite strikeout numbers, elite whips, those kind of things, I think Ponce is the upside play. But out of the two, I think K's got a larger chance to be starting games in August and September than Ponce does.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a lot of soft-tossing lefties with deep arsenals have good seasons lately, so he'd just be another one to add to the list.
Yeah, and then the other two, it's funny you say a soft-tossing lefty. Foster Griffin is a hard avoid for me at this point. I just don't think the stuff plays well enough. He's just a tier down from the other two for me. He still has a chance to be a solid contributor. I just don't see him getting the numbers that I expect from the other two. And Sungmin Song is – he strikes me as a guy that could – give you good power, but his swing path has a lot of concerns. I think the big takeaway scouts have with him is he struggles to hit outside pitches for power. He struggles to do damage on pitches away from him, which if you watch his swing path, it makes sense. He really sells out for pull side power. And when he doesn't get a pitch in that wheelhouse, it's not exactly an optimal result. That said, with good coaching, he's still young. He's still got a chance to turn that around depending on the organization he goes to. But again, he's a tier down because of that factor, because I don't think the swing path plays as well in the big leagues as it does in the KBO.
Yeah, I'm going to be curious how all these guys do, especially the guys coming from the KBO too. Leagues have changed, you know, over the past few years, and the quality has definitely improved. But usually the idea is, like, if you're coming over from the MPB, it's like kind of, you know, going from AAA to the majors, and the KBO, just because the quality of talent's just a little bit lower. It's like come from a high AA team, essentially. So the majors. So just kind of curious, yeah, how those transitions will do for guys like Ponce and Kay, who have pitched in the majors. They know what it's like to be in the majors. And so even though they're coming from a league with maybe, you know, lower quality, maybe that does translate because they have the major league experience.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. Like, these guys know how to be pros. They know how to be big leaguers. Obviously, I think they're coming into larger roles now that they're expected to start games, which might, you know, change their experience a little bit. But they're not coming in with the unfamiliarity that some of the other guys are coming in with, which I think goes in their favor. I think both guys have added to their pitchability, too. They've added to their arsenals. Ponce added a ton of velocity. Kay added, I think, 3 pitches. So these are guys that made serious strides while they were overseas to become starters, and should not be discounted just because they're coming from another league. Mm-hmm. Obviously, as you said, it's kind of a step up going to the big league straight from an overseas league, but they've made legitimate strides, and those numbers that they put up in the NPB and the KBO aren't accidents. They aren't flukes.
Yeah,
I mean, you don't strike out 250 batters in 170 innings pitched without doing something right. So
sure.
They're guys that are worth taking a shot on. Obviously, it depends on your roster build. If you can afford taking a flyer on a guy like Ponce, who may not have elite outings or if you can put a guy like Kay on your bench to, you know, play matchups with. But I think these are both guys that are definitely worth legitimate looks in fantasy leagues, regardless of depth, if you can afford the spot.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you do kind of wrap up the article with some fringe big leaguers, you know, guys that have some significant risk there. Any of those four, I'll just read them off: Hiro Saiki, Kona Takahashi, Drew Anderson, and Kohei Arihara, maybe coming in for a second trip to the majors. Any of those four guys, or maybe just other ones that you were, you know, looking up when you were doing your research, that you think maybe should be getting a little bit more hype? Obviously, you know, maybe not as like first round FYPD talents, but nonetheless, people that you know, managers should be keeping an eye on.
The short answer for the four I mentioned in the article is no. I think that these are guys to avoid in FYPDs this year. There's just not a ton of upside here. And even if there was a little bit, the only player with upside out of those four you mentioned is Saiki, because of, I mean, he already has the name recognition. He was dominant against the Dodgers in the Japan series. The numbers are ridiculous. 1.55 ERA, 1.06 whip. The problem is he's probably not going to get posted. His team tends not to post stars and tends to post players that when they're kind of looking to get rid of them, at least from what I've read and when I was doing my research, doesn't sound likely he's going to get posted. But if he was, he'd be squarely in between the A and B tier of the article, because his stuff is really darn good. And I'm really hoping he comes over, because he's a player I was really excited to watch in the Japan series. Takahashi just doesn't get enough swing and miss for me. He's a guy I'm really worried about his arsenal playing in the United States. Anderson was a guy I originally had in the B tier, but after more research, it sounds like he's not going to come over. And he's got some good offers in Japan to stay over there. Arihara just doesn't really excite me, to be honest. At 33, chances of him getting a starting role are slim, especially for Dynasty, where you've got to worry about multiple years. In multiple years, he's going to be 35, 36 on a fringe starting role. That's just not a player I'm wasting a pick on. There are other guys that did pop up, and I'll hand up accountability. I completely missed Ryan Weiss. Not sure how I missed him. And now that he's been picked up with the Astros, that seems like a match made in heaven. Really solid year in the KBO. Over 10 Ks per nine, ERA under 3. The walk and the contact rate have been worse than the other guys in the article, hence the, you know, more team-friendly contract. But this seems like a really good buy-low candidate for a team that needed pitching in the back end of the rotation. And he's definitely a guy to keep an eye on as the offseason progresses. This could be a guy that kind of breaks out a little bit in the latter half of his career.
All right, cool. Well, thanks again for coming on the show, Jack. And appreciate you not only just writing the article, but also talking through what's kind of going on with these international free agents. Because, yeah, it is easy kind of to get caught up in the hype sometimes. And, you know, nice to know what is, you know, really the impact of, you know, this one player coming over who's, you know, like in Murakami's sequence, might be signing like a nine-figure contract, right? Like, just because he's getting those numbers doesn't necessarily mean that he's a guy that, let's just say in redraft, that you should be, you know, necessarily targeting. Right. Obviously for Dynasty, you know, might make sense to grab him number one in your first player draft, if first year player draft, if you've got that pick. But before we let you go, just, what do you got coming up on Pitcher List? And, if you've got social media, feel free to plug, and how can people, you know, kind of follow your work?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at @Mueller_sports. All of my work will be posted there. I make sure to repost everything that gets posted there. I also have some Tableau visualizations and some little data work I've been toying around with coming out in the next couple of weeks. So stay tuned for that. Next up for me with Pitcher List, I'm working on a post hype prospects to buy in on. Last year, I did the same article last year, and I told everyone to go buy Mickey Moniak. Pretty proud of how that one turned out. So hopefully we'll hit gold again this year. But yeah, thank you guys for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you for giving me a chance to talk about these guys. This has been a really fun article to work on and a really fun project to do over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, appreciate you and, you know, the rest of the Dynasty team giving us something to talk about over this offseason. I mean, obviously, with winter meetings are coming up, hopefully something happens there. I don't know. Knowing baseball, nothing usually happens nowadays around winter meetings. But, obviously, you and the Dynasty team, and I know coming up in January, it's probably going to be a busy month for you guys again as you go through your basically preview list of every single team's farm system. So definitely looking forward to that as that comes up.
Yeah, I'll be in Orlando, so if anything happens, I'll be the first to let everyone know.
Sounds good.
I'll try my best to. And then, I'll be doing five of the organizational rankings come January. So it'll be a busy month for me.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah, you'll find all of that on my social media.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks, Jack. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Jack.
All right. Thanks again to Jack. We are going to just talk about a couple of the moves that have happened over the last 3 weeks since our last episode. A couple big signings, one big-ish trade. If you're a Mets fan, it's a pretty big trade, I guess. But yeah, we're going to talk about a couple moves that happened. We'll start out with your Orioles. Ryan Helsley is your new closer. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's been an active offseason so far for the Orioles. I guess, you know, activity is better than not, even if one of them was a kind of confusing trade. But yeah, I feel good about Helsley. You know, you got to hope as a fan of the team, but also as someone who's thinking about drafting Ryan Helsley, that the Orioles in their meetings with him sat down and said, this is why you struggled so much down the stretch, and this is what we're going to do to fix you and make you, you know, get back to that pretty dominant closer that he was for the last few years. So I feel good about it. I don't think he's going to be a top tier closer, right? There might be some outings where he gives up a little hard contact or maybe walks a couple guys, but I do feel good about him as kind of a good back end closer one on your teams. I think, yeah, I mean, he's obviously got loud stuff. I think some people have talked about the width of the arsenal, maybe leading to a little bit of hard contact. So maybe they'll help him kind of get a more well-rounded three pitch mix. But yeah, overall, I feel good about it. It was definitely a position of need for the Orioles, so I'm glad that they addressed it.
Yeah, and he's going to be firmly the closer for the entire year. I don't think Bautista is coming back next season. I mean, if he does, it's going to be September. And yeah, I don't think that's going to be a position where the Orioles want him to challenge for that closer position. And I think just, you know, probably for any sort of team continuity, it makes sense to keep Helsley there. I did want to ask about that other trade because I forgot about that. It involved one of my favorite players in the league, Taylor Ward. But yeah, he is now an Oriole and he got traded for Grayson Rodriguez. And when I saw that trade come across my board, I legitimately thought that the Orioles got fleeced. But I don't know. How do you feel about this, knowing Grayson Rodriguez, his injury history? And also, I mean, I guess you get another nice power bat in the outfield now.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like the lineup is pretty much rounded out, which is nice, but it was surprising. You know, it's really complicated because, you know, we thought he was going to be an ace for us, right? And he never got there, and now he's never going to get the chance. And we've seen a lot of promising pitching prospects go, you know, Jake Arrieta being another one, right, who didn't find success until he left. Kevin Gausman was decent with us, but hit a whole new level once he left. So you hope that that doesn't happen, but you also don't wish him badly in his career, right? So my kind of thought is, because of the team control disparity, I don't think the Orioles would have made that trade unless they have very little confidence in wherever he's at physically. So, you know, definitely don't wish injury on the guy or anything like that, because, you know, he's a fun pitcher when he's on. But I do think that they, you know, felt like he was damaged goods to some extent. Hopefully he's able to get on the right track. But I'd be lying if I said I felt like the Angels was the best place for him to do that, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's a tough landing spot for him for sure. But yeah, I mean, one of the big reasons I thought it was weird was just because you look at the Orioles rotation and it's not anything scary. And I think, you know, most likely Baltimore is still in the market looking for like a top line starter, whatever that kind of means in their financial context. But yeah, you look at the projected starting rotation on Fangraphs, on Roster Resource, it's Trevor Rogers, who had a great year last year, obviously, Kyle Bradish, Dean Kramer, Tyler Wells, and Cade Povich, and the farm system is... there's not much to speak of there right now. So it did feel very weird that they traded Grayson just from a roster standpoint, but it seems like maybe there might be some other moves down the road potentially. We'll see.
Yeah. I mean, they definitely need to make them now. You know, the way I think of it is they need an SP2. I think Bradish can be the ace. They need an SP2, and then you want everyone down a spot, right? You want Rogers as your three, now your two, Kramer as your four, and then you want like Povich and Young and Wells competing for the five. So I think if they bring one guy in, it changes everything, but they're definitely going to have to shell out some money for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, staying in the AL East, another trade involving a starting pitcher, Sonny Gray was sent from the Cardinals along with cash, which I think is just hilarious. But the Cardinals are literally paying the Red Sox to, you know, take Sonny Gray. They did get Richard Fitz and Brandon Clark back in the trade, but honestly, a great thing for the Red Sox that they didn't have to part with any of their top-tier pitching prospects. like Connolly Early. You know, that's kind of the big name that was mentioned. But yeah, now they've got basically a 1-2 punch of Garrett Crochet and Sonny Gray. Yeah, how do you feel about Sonny now pitching in Boston?
Yeah, I mean, it's an arms race in the division right now. The Jays are making big moves with Cease, and the Red Sox are making moves, so it's going to be competitive. I feel decent about him. I think maybe slight downgrade just in terms of the run environment. You know, Fenway, it's not like a place where people allow a lot of home runs necessarily, like you might think with the short fence and the Green Monster, but it is a pretty hitter-friendly ballpark in terms of run scoring. So I do think that that caps kind of Sonny's upside. And he's already a guy who's shown some ERA vulnerabilities, but he's a guy who you think there'll be some positive regression in terms of his ERA versus his peripherals the last couple of years. And I think he'll still be a good whip asset. And yeah, obviously he's pitching on a better team, right? So more win chances. He's been pretty reliable, albeit, you know, not ace level the last few years. When this trade happened, I saw a headline that called him durable. And I was like, wow, Sonny Gray's come a long way. You know, we haven't really always thought of him as durable, but he has been the last few years.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that was interesting is that the Cardinals defense, I think, ranks as one of the better ones in the league, if I recall. Gray doesn't necessarily have huge ground ball numbers, 44% ground ball rate last year. So it's probably not the biggest downgrade moving to Boston, where, I mean, frankly, it's not that the defense is bad. It's just that they literally have no idea who's playing behind him. Trevor Story is currently lined in as a shortstop. Sedan Rafael is currently, you know, set up as a second baseman according to roster resource. But, you know, those can always change. Vaughn Grissom is still on the team. Herman Gonzalez doesn't really play any of the second or short, but needless to say, you know, it's a team that the defense is kind of in flux right now, at least in the infield. So I don't know if that's really going to affect him with that, you know, kind of lower ground ball rate, but it is something interesting to maybe track that he is going to be losing kind of a little bit more of an elite defense behind him in St. Louis.
Yeah. The outfield there is good, but the infield, like you said, definitely unsteady, uncertain.
We're staying in the AL East because, like you said, it's just an arms race. And Dylan Cease agrees to pretty big contract. Actually, was not really expecting it to be that big, but good for him, I guess. I believe it was $210 for 7 years, right? So a $30 million dollar average. He joins a rotation that, to be honest, was like already pretty solid. Kevin Gausman kind of found his footing last season. Shane Bieber kind of became a pretty decent, not became a decent pitcher. He was already a decent pitcher, but, you know, returning from injury, he looked pretty good. Travis Savage there looks like the real deal. And then now they got Ponce and, you know, like we said, Jose Berríos is now kind of the outside looking in. I don't know. There's a lot of interesting sort of situations there with that rotation. They could still use another guy. That's why they went on and got Cease. But yeah, any thoughts about Cease now going north of the border?
Yeah, surprised to see the dollar figure. I do think with the deferrals, the present value gets knocked down to like between 180 and 190 million. So it's not quite 30 million a year, but still a huge deal. I always thought that Framber was going to get a bigger contract than Cease this offseason just by a little bit. But after seeing this number, I think that that probably isn't the case. I think Cease is maybe the first domino to fall. Yeah, I think he's in a great situation in Toronto, obviously primed for a bounce back season, especially if they can help him develop a third pitch that has kind of eluded him his whole career. And, you know, I think a lot of people have talked about this, but the defense behind Cease last year, San Diego didn't have a bad defense. It just happened to play poorly when he was pitching. So I think, you know, being in Toronto with a pretty solid defense, right? Dalton Varsho is a fantastic center fielder. Ernie Clement's really versatile. Andrés Giménez seems to be able to play second or short. So I think having a Kirk, obviously, is fantastic behind the plate. So I think that, yeah, I think that that will really help him, you know, from an ERA perspective, kind of post a more solid season these next few years.
Yeah, his PLV numbers just overall aren't great. Like even that slider that he's got is not, you know, in a top percentile, so to speak. You know, it's kind of more in the 50 to 75% in terms of its PLV. So would be nice to see him kind of get back to the ace that we kind of knew that he was, you know, both in the White Sox and, you know, a little bit on the Padres as well. But, I mean, he is older, you know, that's a little bit of the reality for Cease. He's going to be turning, I think his age 30 season is next year. Fangraphs right now has him still posted for, you know, 10.5 K per nine, 3.6 ERA, which I think would be quite interesting to see him get that, considering how his ERA has been a little volatile over the past few years. But yeah, like you said, that defense behind him is going to be a little bit better, but he is probably going to be facing, well, actually, no, the offenses that he's facing are probably not going to be that much, probably comparable to what he was facing in the National League, especially in the NL West. So be interesting to see, yeah, what he looks like now going to be in Toronto.
Yeah, he's one of those SP2 types or SP3 types that you go for more for the strikeouts and the wins rather than the ratio quality. Maybe kind of like Jesus Luzardo or somebody like that who, you know, there's a little volatility there, but he piles up the strikeouts and obviously he's pitching on a great team now.
Yeah. All right. Well, going to a trade that, I don't know, feels kind of weird, but it happened, so we're going to talk about it. But Brandon Nimmo traded for Marcus Semien. Semien arguably one of the worst seasons he's had in a while. I don't know. Wasn't that great. 15 homers, 11 stolen bases, 127 games. You know, he hit .230. Nothing really interesting there. But Nimmo also not necessarily having had a great season either. Both of those guys are, you know, on the wrong side of 30 as well. It just felt weird because Nimmo felt like a lifer in New York, and then they basically traded him because he didn't have a great season, and yet the season was still fine, right? 25 homers, 13 stolen bases, batted .260. Mm-hmm. You know, the numbers wise, it just looked really, it seemed weird that they were trading him for Semien, essentially. I'll just say that. So any thoughts of either of those guys in their new homes, you know, whether it's going to be an improvement or a downgrade for either of them?
Yeah, I think I'll start with Nimmo first. It's definitely a lineup, or at least a run scoring environment downgrade. I know both parks are pretty pitcher friendly, but Texas especially, I think it was maybe the most pitcher friendly park in the league last year. Nimmo's still going to hit top of the order, probably leadoff, so that's nice. But Texas offense really struggled last year, so that's a little bit concerning. He's a really solid, well-rounded contributor, but he doesn't stand out anywhere, so kind of a decent accumulator, but the runs and RBIs might take a step back. And then Semien, obviously, he's getting into a much better run-scoring environment, but he's the one whose offensive profile has really fallen off, right? So I think for Nimmo, it's more been the defense. For Semien, it's been the offense, which we care about more in fantasy. So second base, though, it's not a good position, right? So Semien's still going to have his viability, it does seem like he's going to be in there every day like he's known to do, unless he has a freak injury. So, yeah, I think that Semien could be like a decent buy low. And Nimmo's the type of guy who, even when he has a good year, his price doesn't get crazy. So maybe like pick 150 or something like that, you start eyeing a guy like him.
Yeah, I just don't understand. I mean, maybe it's a money thing. That's probably the only reason why they were willing to trade Nimmo for Semien, but the numbers for him like aren't bad. So yeah, it's kind of confusing why they decided to make that trade. And I think the money actually ends up being around the same because Semien also was making a decent amount too. So outfielder 17 according to the player rater for Nimmo, so he's still very much a viable fantasy asset. And then, you know, going back to the Mets, they signed Devin Williams, which kind of interesting, I think, for two reasons. One, when Williams was on the Yankees, you know, he was kind of flip-flopping between being the closer, being the setup guy, and I think he ended the season as the setup guy as they decided to go to Bednar a little bit more often in the ninth. And then now he goes to the Mets, where Edwin Diaz is still firmly the closer there, and it sounds like Semien is more than willing to be a setup man. You know, when Williams was in Milwaukee, I think he was still worth picking up in saves-only leagues just because of how good he was. Yes, he wasn't getting the saves, but, you know, the ratios, the strikeouts were really, really solid. But it's been a few years since that point. You know, the stuff's regressed a little bit. If Williams is firmly just kind of the eighth inning guy in New York, is he someone that you still would be interested in looking at in a redraft league?
Probably just late if he's the eighth inning guy. I mean, Diaz is a free agent. It seems like the Mets are still going to go after him, maybe. So that would be, you know, a pretty crazy 8-9 combo, Diaz and Williams there. But, you know, wouldn't put anything past Steve Cohen, right? I think that if he is strictly in that role, I would have pretty tepid interest. But I do think at this point, he's got a decent chance to be in the ninth, unless the Mets are going to go and shell out all that money. I do think there's, you know, there's instances, right? We want to do independent analysis and we want to, you know, form our own conclusions. But I think we also should let, you know, the decisions of major league teams speak for themselves. And then the idea that Devin Williams is getting 3 years, $51 million, albeit with some deferrals, right? So maybe it's more like 45 or 48. That tells me that the league still thinks that he's a really good relief pitcher, unless the Mets just blew everybody else's offers out of the water. So yeah, that tells me that they have a lot of confidence in him to bounce back and get close to being a borderline elite guy. And then some of the underlying stuff does suggest that. So I wouldn't be surprised to see it. Again, there's some two pitch concerns, right? Fastball, changeup, and the fastball, it's really just the changeup is the plus offering. So he is very reliant on it, but it's one hiccup in a long career of success. So yeah, I'm inclined to believe he's going to have a pretty solid season.
Yeah. And you do bring up a good point. Diaz is technically not on the Mets right now because he is on site, but it seems to, I don't know. There seems to be smoke that the Mets do want to bring him back. So I don't know. I kind of read somewhere that they were like, hey, if you're in the eighth inning role, would you be okay with that? And Williams was. So it sounds like they're maybe making a push to bring Diaz back, but yeah, I don't know. It's going to be an interesting conversation for sure as the offseason goes on of, you know, whether Williams is going to be in that closer role or not come opening day.
Yes, it's hard to believe they won't bring back either Diaz or Alonso just with how much money they're willing to spend. You know, you got to think one of those guys will stay.
Yeah, I mean, with winter meetings up coming up, as I mentioned, I mean, it's been winter meetings has just been slow for the last few years anyways. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't get any sort of big news on the guys like Kyle Tucker or Pete Alonso, but I would be surprised that they don't bring up back Alonso, but they just traded Nimmo, so I don't know. I don't know about the Mets right now, but it would be surprising if they basically don't re-sign at least one of those two kind of former cornerstones of their team. All right, well, that's going to wrap it up for This Week in Fantasy Baseball. Again, you can find us at This Week PL on Twitter. Send us your comments and questions at thisweekplpod@gmail.com. You can find myself on Twitter at TheJohnCa. You can find Patrick at PFitzgerald_99. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to the Pitcherless podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, wherever else you listen to your podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review if you enjoy the show. Lastly, sign up for Pitcherless Pro. By doing so, you can join us on the Pitcherless Discord. Get advice from all the fantasy experts and writers over there. Yes, it's the off season, but we're still talking about baseball, so definitely come in and check it out. But yeah, that's all for this week. We'll be back next time with another episode of This Week in Fantasy Baseball. For Patrick, I'm John, and we'll see you in the next one. Later, everyone.